Hello, welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a feature article by Bala et al. Non-invasive surrogate for physiologic dead space using the carbon dioxide ventilatory equivalent, testing in a single center cohort from 2017 to 2023. Objectives. We sought to evaluate the association between the carbon dioxide ventilatory equivalent, a marker of dead space that does not require a blood gas measurement, and mortality risk. The carbon dioxide ventilatory equivalent is equal to minute ventilation divided by volume of carbon dioxide produced per minute. We compared the strength of this association to that of physiologic dead space fraction, as well as to other commonly used markers of dead space, including the end-tidal alveolar dead space fraction and the ventilatory ratio. Physiologic dead space fraction is defined as the volume of dead space divided by tidal volume, which is equal to PaCO2 minus the mixed expired PCO2 divided by PaCO2. End-tidal alveolar dead space fraction is equal to PaCO2 minus end-tidal PCO2 divided by PaCO2. Ventilatory ratio is equal to minute ventilation times PaCO2 divided by age-adjusted predicted minute ventilation times 37.5. Design: retrospective cohort data from 2017 to 2023. Setting: quaternary PICU. Patients: 131 children with acute respiratory distress syndrome. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. All dead space markers were calculated at the same 1 minute time point for each patient within the first 72 hours of using invasive mechanical ventilation. The 131 children had a median age of 5.8 years with an interquartile range of 1.4 to 12.6 years, an oxygenation index of 7.5 with an interquartile range of 4.6 to 14.3, a physiologic dead space fraction of 0.47 with an interquartile range of 0.38 to 0.61, and mortality was 17.6%, or 23 of 131. Higher carbon dioxide ventilatory equivalent had a p-value equal to 0.003, physiologic dead space fraction had a p-value equal to 0.002, and ventilatory ratio had a p-value equal to 0.013, and were all associated with greater odds of mortality in multivariable models adjusting for OI, immunosuppressive comorbidity, and overall severity of illness. We failed to identify an association between alveolar dead space fraction and mortality in the multivariable modeling. Similarly, we also failed to identify an association between OI and mortality after controlling for any dead space marker in the modeling. For the 28-day ventilator-free days outcome, we failed to identify an association between physiologic dead space fraction and the dead space markers in multivariable modeling, although OI was significant. Conclusions: carbon dioxide ventilatory equivalent performs similarly to physiologic dead space fraction and other surrogate dead space markers, is independently associated with mortality risk, and may be a reasonable non-invasive surrogate for dead space fraction. Abstract 2 is a feature article by Ashworth et al. Associations of patient and parent characteristics with parental decision regret in the PICU, a secondary analysis of the 2015 to 2017 Navigate randomized comparative trial. Objectives: to identify self-reported meaningful decisions made by parents in the PICU and to determine patient and parent characteristics associated with the development of parental decision regret, a measurable self-reported outcome associated with psychologic morbidity. Design: secondary analysis of the Navigate randomized comparative trial. Setting: two tertiary academic PICUs. Subjects: Spanish or English-speaking parents of PICU patients aged less than 18 years who are expected to remain in the PICU for greater than 24 hours from time of enrollment, or who had a risk of mortality greater than 4% based on pediatric index of mortality 2 score. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Between April 2015 and March 2017, 233 parents of 209 patients completed a survey 3 to 5 weeks post-PICU discharge, which included the decision regret scale, a 5-item, 5-point Likert scale tool scored from 0, defined as no regret, to 100, defined as maximum regret. 209 patient and parent dyads were analyzed. The decisions parents reported as most important were categorized as the following: procedure, respiratory support, medical management, parent-staff interactions and communication, symptom management, fluid electrolytes nutrition, and no decision. 51% of parents had some decision regret, with 19% scoring in the moderate to severe range, or decision regret scale score of 26 to 100. The mean decision regret scale score was 12.7, with a standard deviation of 18.1. Multivariable analysis showed that parental Hispanic ethnicity was associated with greater odds of mild regret, with an odds ratio of 3.12, a 95% confidence interval of 1.36 to 7.13, and a p-value equal to 0.007. Being parents of a patient with an increased PICU length of stay or underlying respiratory disease was associated with greater odds of moderate to severe regret. Increased PICU length of stay had an odds ratio of 1.03, a 95% confidence interval of 1.009 to 1.049, and a p-value equal to 0.004. Underlying respiratory disease had an odds ratio of 2.91, a 95% confidence interval of 1.22 to 6.94, and a p-value equal to 0.02. Conclusions. Decision regret was experienced by half of PICU parents in the 2015 to 2017 Navigate study. The characteristics associated with decision regret, including parental ethnicity, PICU length of stay, and respiratory disease, are easily identifiable. Further study is needed to understand what contributes to regret in this population and what interventions could provide support and minimize the development of regret. Abstract 3 is a feature article by Lenz et al. Social Determinants of Health and Health-Related Quality of Life Following Pediatric Septic Shock, Secondary Analysis of the Life After Pediatric Sepsis Evaluation Dataset from 2014 to 2017. Objectives. Social determinants of health are associated with disparities in disease severity and in-hospital outcomes among critically ill children. It is unknown whether social determinants of health are associated with later outcomes. We evaluated associations between social determinants of health measures and mortality, new functional morbidity, and health-related quality of life decline among children surviving septic shock. Design. Secondary analysis of the Life After Pediatric Sepsis Evaluation or LAPS prospective cohort study, and it was conducted between 2014 and 2017. Setting. 12 academic U.S. PICUs were involved in the study. Patients. Children younger than 18 years with community-acquired septic shock were involved in the study. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We assessed associations between race, ethnicity, income, education, marital status, insurance, language, and home U.S. postal code with 28-day mortality, new functional morbidity at discharge per day 28, and health-related quality of life decline using logistic regression. Of 389 patients, 32% or N equal to 98 of families had household income less than $50,000 per year. Median pediatric risk of mortality or PRISM score was 11, with an interquartile range of 6 to 17. We found that English language and area deprivation index less than 50th percentile were associated with higher PRISM scores. Mortality was 6.7% with an N equal to 26. New functional morbidity occurred in 21.8% or an N equal to 78 patients, and health-related quality of life decline by greater than 10% occurred in 31% of patients with an N equal to 63. We failed to identify any association between social determinants of health measures and mortality, new functional morbidity, or health-related quality of life decline. We are unable to exclude the possibility that annual household income greater than or equal to $50,000 was associated with up to 81% lesser odds of mortality and, in survivors, more than threefold greater odds of health-related quality of life decline by greater than 10%. Conclusions. In this secondary analysis of the 2014 to 2017 LAPS dataset, we failed to identify any association between social determinants of health measures and in-hospital or post-discharge outcomes following pediatric septic shock. This finding may be reflective of the high illness severity and single disease, sepsis, of the cohort, with contribution of clinical factors to functional and health-related quality of life outcomes predominating over pre-hospital and post-hospital social determinants of health factors. Abstract 4 is a feature article by Killian et al. Pediatric Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome Severity and Health-Related Quality of Life Outcomes, Single Center Retrospective Cohort, 2011 to 2017. Objectives. to determine factors associated with health-related quality of life decline among pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome survivors. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: academic children's hospital. Patients: 315 children 1 month to 18 years old with an unplanned PICU admission from December 2011 to February 2017 enrolled in the hospital's outcomes assessment program. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: pre-admission baseline and median 6-week post-discharge health-related quality of life were assessed using the Pediatric Quality of Life Inventory, or the Functional Status 2R. Patients meeting retrospectively applied secondary pediatric acute lung injury consensus conference criteria for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome were identified, and pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome severity was classified using binary, mild or moderate and severe, and trachomatous, mild, moderate, or severe categorization for non-invasive ventilation and invasive mechanical ventilation. Pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome occurred in 41 of 315 children, or 13%. Clinically important health-related quality of life decline, or greater than or equal to 4.5 points, occurred in 17 of 41 patients, or 41.5%, with pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, and 64 of 274 without pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, 23.4%. On multivariable generalized linear regression adjusted for age, baseline pediatric overall performance category, maximum non-respiratory pediatric logistic organ dysfunction score, diagnosis, length of stay, and time to follow-up, pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome was associated with health-related quality of life decline with an adjusted relative risk of 1.7 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.03 to 2.77. 4-hour and maximum pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome severity were the only factors associated with health-related quality of life decline. Health-related decline occurred in 5 of 18 patients with mild pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome at 4 hours, 5 of 13 with moderate pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome with an adjusted relative risk of 2.35 versus no pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome with a 95% confidence interval of 1.01 to 5.5, and 7 of 10 with severe pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome with an adjusted relative risk of 2.56 versus no pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome with a 95% confidence interval of 1.45 to 4.53. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve for discrimination of health-related quality of life decline for invasive mechanical ventilation patients was 0.79 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.66 to 0.91 for binary and 0.8 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.69 to 0.93 for trachomatous severity categorization. Conclusions: health-related quality of life decline is common among children surviving pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, and risk of decline is associated with pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome severity. Health-related quality of life decline from baseline may be an efficient and clinically meaningful endpoint to incorporate into pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome clinical trials. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation by Slane et al. Race, ethnicity, and intensive care utilization for common pediatric diagnoses, U.S. Pediatric Health Information System 2019 database study. Objectives: racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare delivery for acutely ill children are pervasive in the United States. It is unknown whether differential critical care utilization exists. Design: retrospective study of the Pediatric Health Information System, or PHIS, database. Setting: multicenter database of academic children's hospitals in the United States. Patients: children discharged from a PHIS hospital in 2019 with one of the top 10 medical conditions where PICU utilization was present in greater than or equal to 5% of hospitalizations. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: race and ethnicity categories included Asian, Black, Hispanic, White, and Other. Primary outcomes of interest were differences in rate of PICU admission, and for children requiring PICU care, total hospital length of stay. 1/4, or an N equal to 44,200, of the 178,134 hospital discharges included a PICU admission. In adjusted models, Black children had greater adjusted odds ratio of PICU admission in bronchiolitis, respiratory failure, seizure, and diabetic ketoacidosis. Bronchiolitis adjusted odds ratio was 1.08 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.02 to 1.14 and a p-value equal to 0.01. Respiratory failure adjusted odds ratio was 1.18 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.1 to 1.28 and a p-value less than 0.001. Seizure adjusted odds ratio was 1.28 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 1.51 and a p-value equal to 0.004. Diabetic ketoacidosis adjusted odds ratio was 1.18 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.05 to 1.32 and a p-value equal to 0.006. Together, Hispanic, Asian, and other race children had greater adjusted odds ratio of PICU admission in five of the diagnostic categories compared with white children. The geometric mean hospital length of stay ranged from 47.7 hours plus or minus 2.1 hours standard deviation in croup to 206.6 hours plus or minus 2.8 hours standard deviation in sepsis. After adjusting for demographics and illness severity, children from families of color had longer length of stay in respiratory failure, pneumonia, DKA, and sepsis. Conclusions: the need for critical care to treat acute illness in children may be inequitable. Additional studies are needed to understand and eradicate differences in PICU utilization based on race and ethnicity. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation by Patel et al. Postoperative delirium screening characteristics in pediatric intestinal, liver, and renal transplant recipients, single-center retrospective cohort study. Objectives: to describe and compare the results of delirium screening in the immediate post-transplant PICU admission for pediatric intestinal, liver, and renal transplant recipients. We also examined associations with known and suspected risk factors for pediatric delirium. Design: retrospective analysis of a single-center cohort from 2016 to 2022. Setting: 24-bed PICU in a high-volume transplant center. Patients: all intestinal, liver, and renal transplant recipients under 23 years old admitted between July 2016 and August 2022. Measurements and main results: we identified 211 pediatric transplant recipients. Intestinal had an N equal to 36, liver had an N equal to 78, and renal had an N equal to 97. Results of the Cornell assessment for pediatric delirium during the immediate post-transplant PICU admission were reviewed, and patients were categorized into screen positive, screen negative, and unscreened. Corresponding data on known and suspected risk factors for pediatric delirium were also collected. Data on delirium subtypes were not collected. Screens were available for 156 of 211 patients, or 74%, who were included in the final analysis. The prevalence of a positive screen by transplant category was: intestine, 80%, or 24 of 30, liver, 75%, or 47 of 63, and renal, 14%, or 9 of 63. A positive screen was associated with younger age, greater duration of mechanical ventilation, and greater PICU length of stay in bivariate analysis. In multivariable analysis, age and PICU length of stay remained strongly correlated with a positive screen with a p-value less than 0.05. Deep sedation and agitation as categorized by the State Behavioral Scale was associated with a positive screen, as was significant iatrogenic withdrawal symptoms with a p-value less than 0.05. Most patients screened positive by post-transplant day 2, 58 of 80 or 72%, and day 3, or 64 of 80 or 80%. Conclusions: in our 2016 to 2022 experience, we found a high prevalence of positive pediatric delirium screens in pediatric intestinal and liver transplant recipients in the immediate post-transplant PICU admission. A positive screen was associated with younger age and greater PICU length of stay. Abstract 7 is a clinical investigation by Fernandez Sarmiento et al. Time course of mechanical ventilation driving pressure levels in pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. Outcomes in a prospective multicenter cohort study from Columbia, 2018 to 2022. Objectives: high driving pressure, where driving pressure is the ratio of tidal volume over respiratory system compliance, is a risk for poor outcomes in patients with pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. We therefore assessed the time course in level of driving pressure, IDEST 24, 48, and 72 hours after starting mechanical ventilation and its association with 28-day mortality. Design. Multi-center prospective study conducted between February 2018 and December 2022. Setting. 12 tertiary care PICUs in Colombia. Patients. 184 intubated children with moderate to severe pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The median age of the pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome cohort was 11 months, with an interquartile range of 3 to 24 months. A total of 129 of 184 patients, or 70.2%, had a pulmonary etiology leading to pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, and 31 of 184 patients, or 16.8%, died. In the first 24 hours after admission, the plateau pressure in the non-survivor group compared with the survivor group differed. The median plateau pressure in the non-survivor group was 28.24, with an interquartile range of 24.14 to 32.11, whereas the median plateau pressure in the survivor group was 23.18, with an interquartile range of 20.72 to 27.13 centimeters of water, with a p-value less than 0.01. Of note, children with a tidal volume less than 8 milliliters per kilogram of ideal body weight had lower adjusted odds ratio of 28-day mortality, with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.69, a 95% confidence interval of 0.55 to 0.87, and a p-value equal to 0.02. However, we failed to identify an association between driving pressure level and the oxygenation index at each time point, with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.58 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.21 to 1.58. In a diagnostic exploratory analysis, we found that driving pressure greater than 15 centimeters of water at 72 hours was an explanatory variable for mortality, with area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of 0.83 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.74 to 0.89. There was also increased hazard for death, with a hazard ratio of 2.5 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.07 to 5.92. Driving pressure greater than 15 centimeters of water at 72 hours was also associated with longer duration of mechanical ventilation, 10 with an interquartile range of 7 to 14 versus 7 with an interquartile range of 5 to 10 days, with a p-value equal to 0.02. Conclusions. In children with moderate to severe pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, a driving pressure greater than 15 centimeters of water at 72 hours after the initiation of mechanical ventilation is associated with greater odds of 28-day mortality and a longer duration of mechanical ventilation. Driving pressure should be considered a variable worth monitoring during protective ventilation for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. Abstract 8 is an online clinical investigation by Sitar et al. Accuracy and interpretation of transcutaneous carbon dioxide monitoring in critically ill children. Objectives. Transcutaneous carbon dioxide, or TCCO2, monitoring can non-invasively assess ventilation by estimating carbon dioxide, or CO2, levels in the blood. We aim to evaluate the accuracy of transcutaneous carbon dioxide monitoring in critically ill children by comparing it to the partial pressure of arterial carbon dioxide, or PaCO2. In addition, we sought to determine the variation between transcutaneous carbon dioxide and PaCO2 acceptable to clinicians to modify patient care, and to determine which patient-level factors may affect the accuracy of transcutaneous carbon dioxide measurements. Design. Retrospective observational cohort study. Setting. Single quaternary care PICU from July 1, 2012 to August 1, 2020. Patients. Included participants were admitted to the PICU and received non-invasive ventilation support, IDEST continuous or bi-level positive airway pressure, conventional mechanical ventilation, or high-frequency oscillatory or percussive ventilation with transcutaneous carbon dioxide measurements obtained within 15 minutes of PaCO2 measurement. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. 3,407 paired arterial blood gas and transcutaneous carbon dioxide measurements were obtained from 264 patients. Bland-Altman analysis revealed a bias of negative 4.4 millimeters of mercury with a 95% confidence interval of -27 to 18.3 millimeters of mercury for transcutaneous carbon dioxide levels against PaCO2 levels on the first measurement pair for each patient, which fell within the acceptable range of plus or minus 5 millimeters of mercury stated by surveyed clinicians, albeit with wide limits of agreement. The sensitivity and specificity of transcutaneous carbon dioxide to diagnose hypercarbia were 93% and 71%, respectively. Vasoactive infusion score, age, and self-identified Black or African American race confounded the relationship between transcutaneous carbon dioxide with PaCO2, but percent fluid overload, weight for age, probe location, and severity of illness were not significantly associated with transcutaneous carbon dioxide accuracy. Conclusions. Transcutaneous carbon dioxide monitoring may be a useful adjunct to monitor ventilation in children with respiratory failure, but providers must be aware of the limitations to its accuracy. Abstract 9 is an online PCCM trial by Armstrong et al. Impact of legal guardian absence on research enrollment in the PICU. Objectives: to identify the frequency of which a legal guardian is at the bedside of children admitted to the PICU that are eligible for research studies. Design: a prospective observational study. Setting: 3 tertiary Canadian PICUs. Patients: 201 patients were admitted to the PICU between September 2021 and March 2023, Site 1, from March 2019 to March 2020, and March 2022 to March 2023, Site 2, and from March 2019 to March 2020 and July 2020 to November 2021, Site 3. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. At each center, the duration of consent encounters was recorded for patients eligible for research by documenting the length of each attempt in minutes. The frequency of parental presence at bedside and the ability for a guardian to make a decision were also recorded. 35% of patients eligible for research did not have a legal guardian at the bedside on the first attempted consent or encounter. 23% of approached patients were not enrolled due to an inability for a consent decision to be made by the child's legal guardian or an inability to contact the guardian before discharge. Conclusions. The absence of legal guardians in the PICU poses a barrier to the enrollment of critically ill children in pertinent research studies and suggests that a model of deferred consent or implied consent would aid in the future of critical care research. Abstract 10 is an online PCCM trial by Naber et al. Protocol for the Prone and Oscillation Pediatric Clinical Trial, or PROSPECT. Objectives. Respiratory management for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome remains largely supportive without data to support one approach over another, including supine versus prone positioning and conventional mechanical ventilation versus high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. Design. We present the research methodology of a global, multi-center, 2x2 factorial, response-adaptive, randomized control trial of supine versus prone positioning and conventional mechanical ventilation versus high-frequency oscillatory ventilation in high, moderate to severe pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, the Prone and Oscillation Pediatric Clinical Trial, or PROSPECT. Setting: approximately 60 PICUs with on-site extracorporeal membrane oxygenation support in North and South America, Europe, Asia, and Oceania, with experience using prone positioning and high-frequency oscillatory ventilation in the care of patients with pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. Patients: eligible pediatric patients 2 weeks old or older and younger than 21 years old are randomized within 48 hours of meeting eligibility criteria occurring within 96 hours of endotracheal intubation. Interventions: one of four arms, including supine and conventional mechanical ventilation, prone and conventional mechanical ventilation, supine and high-frequency oscillatory ventilation, or prone and high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. We hypothesize that children with high, moderate to severe pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome treated with prone positioning or high-frequency oscillatory ventilation will demonstrate greater than or equal to 2 additional ventilator-free days. Measurements and main results. The primary outcome is ventilator-free days through day 28. Non-survivors receive 0 ventilator-free days. Secondary and exploratory outcomes include non-pulmonary organ failure-free days, interaction effects of prone positioning with high-frequency oscillatory ventilation on ventilator-free days, 90-day in-hospital mortality, and among survivors, duration of mechanical ventilation, PICU and hospital length of stay, and post-PICU functional status and health-related quality of life. Up to 600 patients will be randomized, stratified by age group, and direct or indirect lung injury. Adaptive randomization will first occur 28 days after 300 patients are randomized and every 100 patients thereafter. At these randomization updates, new allocation probabilities will be computed based on intention to treat trial results, increasing allocation to well-performing arms and decreasing allocation to poorly performing arms. Data will be analyzed per intention to treat for the primary analyses and per protocol for primary, secondary, and exploratory analyses. Conclusions. PROSPECT will provide clinicians with data to inform the practice of prone positioning and high-frequency oscillatory ventilation in pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. The online letter to the editor this month is by Drs. Reddy, Bricklin, and Woods Hill. Implementation of a firearm safety program in the PICU, a single-center provider survey. In 2020, firearm-related injuries became the leading cause of death in children and adolescents in the United States. Data from Virtual Pediatric Systems, or VPS, showed that those who survived to PICU admission had 12% mortality, more than five times the rate of all-cause PICU mortality. Furthermore, the Pediatric Health Information Systems Database, or PHIS database, from 2004 to 2017 showed critical care resource utilization and costs for firearm-related injuries are increasing in U.S. children's hospitals. Safety Check, an intervention inclusive of safe storage counseling and provision of a gun lock, is an evidence-based practice to reduce firearm injury and death. Current implementation of Safety Check is mostly in the primary care setting, but we believe that translating such practice to the PICU would be important and well-suited to an implementation science approach. First, however, contextual inquiry is needed so that factors that influence clinician behavior, including barriers and facilitators to implementation, are formally evaluated. We completed this contextual inquiry by surveying clinical providers before implementing a firearm safety program in the PICU. The PCCM narrative this month is by Dr. Tessie October, Existing in a Post-Crisis World. My life is now measured in pre-cardiac arrest and post-cardiac arrest phases. It is the fulcrum that determines how I see the world and the decisions I make going forward. In the summer of 2022, my husband suffered an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest while on vacation in the Caribbean. The data tell me that only 30% receive return of spontaneous circulation, 10% survive to hospital discharge, and among survivors, only 20% remain neurologically intact. These statistics floated in my head as I resuscitated my husband, as we drove to the hospital, as we entered the doors of the emergency department, and when those doors closed with me on the outside while resuscitation continued. The odds for a favorable outcome were slim, so as a critical care and palliative care doctor, I forced myself to think about my values, my husband's values, and our goals of care before knowing the outcome. I knew the instant those doors closed that I would opt for a much higher level of disability than I had ever thought I would or could. In my mind, I had already constructed the ramp to our house that is perched atop a hill and had reconfigured our entry-level guest room. Any extra time on this earth was meaningful. We needed more time. Against the odds, my husband survived the out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and is neurologically intact. Although grateful for the favorable outcome, I was forever changed. A good friend of mine who visited me in the hospital a few days after my husband was airlifted to the United States said I looked broken, and it scared her. In such a short time, I had become a shell of myself and was trying desperately to navigate my way back. Months later, while still quietly walking in a fog, I re-engaged with work as an intensivist and scientist. I cared for patients, evaluated grants, and attended conferences. One session I attended was the 2023 Society of Critical Care Medicine Congress plenary lecture, Wife and Death, featuring Dr. and Lady Glockenflecken. In that talk, Lady Glockenflecken spoke of going to the quiet place when learning to cope after her husband's cardiac arrest. I realized I was permanently residing in that quiet place. When Lady Glockenflecken described performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation on her husband, I cried in silence. I felt her pain and connected with her story because her story was my story and the story of many other caregivers. Even when the resuscitation is successful, we wear the scars. I cried for all of us who experienced that trauma and were mourning the loss of normalcy as we once knew it. One of my greatest joys is writing. Article writing, grant writing, journaling, even writing to-do lists. For 2 years, I could not get the words out. The muscle memory of thinking, writing, and living were lost. I was lost. It took time, but I've accepted the reality that there is no going back. The new me can only exist in the post-cardiac arrest world. The lens I see the world through includes new fears. Grandest of them all is an acceptance of mortality. Worry now lurks around corners and appears unexpectedly. When purchasing a plane ticket, I must blink away images of the rescue flight. The whir of an ambulance makes my heart skip as I empathize for the family who may also now live in a post-crisis world. And every cough from my husband puts my ears on heightened alert. This post-crisis existence is also filled with new possibilities, gratitude, and love. During that lecture, as I silently cried, feeling so alone, I experienced the power of love. I was sitting in a packed auditorium of multi-professionals in critical care, many of whom knew my story. As I looked to the left, I received gentle stares of compassion. To my right, a hand appeared on top of my hand with a soft squeeze. My phone was in a state of flutter from the buzzing texts of heart emojis and empathetic messages from colleagues cocooning me with warmth. We are caretakers in critical care. We understand deeply the costs paid daily when health is not guaranteed, and we are not afraid to lean into love. I was wrong in thinking I was suffering alone. This is the love we show to our patients and their families. Almost every family we encounter in the ICU is existing along the continuum of a post-crisis world. It is a world with new fears and setbacks, but also new joys. Our capacity for compassion has no boundaries. We see, live, and bear witness to crises every day. That experience shapes us and prepares us to find ways to send a signal to those who are suffering. Send a signal that we see them, we feel for them, and we care about them. Be it a smile, a nod, or a warm touch. Sometimes that simple expression of humanity lets our patients and their families see a way forward even when the road feels bleak. I have found the will to write again because of the acts of love I received from the palliative care and critical care community. I write this love letter for two audiences. For those suffering in silence as you struggle with your own crisis, I see you. For clinicians who bring love into the ICU for all patients existing in a post-crisis world, we are grateful. This concludes the abstracts for the September issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.